So Greg and Andy between yesterday and today explained how physics can be used to derive solutions of wall crossing formulas. So this is the work of Moore, of Gaiotto. Moore, Andy. And what I'd like to do in the vein of Jan's talk is explain how equally mathematics gives rise to solutions of the wall crossing formula. And this is something that really began with the work of Marcus Reinecke, was taken up by Joyce and continued by Koncevich and Seugelmann. Right, so good point. So that means roughly to find a context in which it holds, but most importantly, it means that to be able to produce, spit out some numbers which satisfy that formula. So you can get them from physics, and I'll explain how you can get them from a constructional experiment. And then, so that's the first thing I would like to explain. And then the second thing I'd like to explain is how this is related to isomonodromic deformations and Frobenius manifold-like structures. This is my joint work with Tom Bridgnett. Okay, so let me begin with the beginning. I'm going to choose a far more modest arena than Jan was working in. So I'm going to choose an abelian category A. So you should think of this as a category of brains, by which I mean all brains. I mean not just physical BPS ones, but not anti-brains. Okay, so to get brains and anti-brains, you have to use a triangulated category instead, and this was the context in which Ian's talk was taking place. So let me give just two basic examples to say what kind of categories I have in mind. The first is going to be the representations of say the A2 quiver, for example. And then, in this category, we have the indecomposables, so the generating brains, if you will, which are called S1, which is the representation which has C here and 0 there, and then S2, 0 here, S here, and then S, which is C here, and then just say multiplication by one here. So again, in some models that physicists are used to working with, probably you don't see all three brains. Well, what the reason is, as I'll come to in a second, that one of them will be regarded as non-physical. But for now, we're just listing all brains. Okay. So of course, any brain here will be a combination of these three. And another category with a more geometric feel will be, for example, the category of coherent sheaves over a smooth, say, projective variety over C. And in this case, we're thinking about B brains. The charge of S is a combination of S1 and S2, but not the object itself, right? So S, you see, contains S2 here, but does not contain S1. So, I mean, you would say that you have a short exact sequence like this here, okay, which is not split. Yes. Right. I mean, suppose if it had been split, it would have been yes, which is at this point. Okay. So next, I'm going to talk about charges. So we're going to take the Grothendieck group of the abelian category. Again, this is what you think of as the lattice where charges live. And for example, if you take the Grothendieck group of that quiver, well, this is just two copies of Z. And if you take the Grothendieck group of coherent sheaves on X, and here I'm going to assume that X is, say, algebraic curve, so it's of dimension 1, then you get, again, two copies of Z. But here there's a small subtlety that I have to actually take a far smaller K-group, which is the so-called numerical K-group. So I'm not going to discuss that. But suffice it to say that this isomorphism here is given by associating to a sheaf the pair given by the degree of the sheaf and its rank. Yes, in this case, yes. Okay, so those are the charges. Now I want to talk about a stability condition on this category. So this is going to correspond to a central charge. And this is what will allow us to then define what we mean by a physical brain or a physical object and a non-physical one. But let me first define what a stability condition is. Well, it is very simple. It's just a homomorphism from the lattice of charges to the complex numbers, which has the positivity property that when I take an actual object as opposed to minus an object, then I map it into the upper half plane, which is here semi-closed. So this is the z's in C with mz positive, and then this joint union with a negative real with real line. That's right, yes. So this lives in, yes, what's called, it's the cone generated by the decomposables in the first example. In the second example, it's all actual vector bundles as opposed to virtual vector bundles. Okay, so what does such a thing look like? Well, if we take the representations of the quiver, then we already observed that the K group is generated by two elements, and correspondingly, a stability condition will just be given by prescribing two complex numbers of two. I had three indecomposables, absolutely. Yes, because, yes, yes, right. So remember, in the isomorphism class, S is not the sum of S1 and S2, but the charge of S is the sum of S1 plus S2. So the K group is really kind of, you're modding out by a lot. You're semi-simplifying things, essentially. So then a central charge here is specifying by just attaching prescribing two complex numbers in the semi-closed upper half plane. Okay. And in the second case, when we talk about coherent sheaves, well, a good stability condition, or a natural one, the one that one uses when one studies vector bundles, is given by associating to a sheaf minus its degree plus I times the rank. Well, this is a natural choice, sort of one that one is familiar with from say, playing with vector bundles on curves. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, you have higher Turing classes, right? Okay, so having decided what a stability, what a central charge is, now let's define semi-stable objects. So with these are the ones that are going to correspond to the BPS brains. So for a given object in the category, I'm going to introduce a numerical quantity which we'll call the phase of the object, which is simply going to be the argument of, 1 over pi times the argument of its central charge. So because the central charge is in the upper half plane, this is a number between 0 and 1. So this is a replacement for the slope of an object. It's just an equivalent notion. No, it's a number that defines modulo nothing, right? Because of my prescription that if I take an object, I should land on the upper half plane. So then I have a determination of the argument there, and there's no problem. Again, you're absolutely right. Then in a triangulated category, then you have to be careful. But here, we're in a abelian category, so everything is on one side. Okay, so that's the definition of the phase. Yes. Yes, because that's right. Because if I have a torsion sheaf, yes, that's right. So if I have a torsion sheaf, I just want to. Okay. And now, what am I going to? So I'm going to say that M is semi-stable, and of course, this definition depends upon the choice of Z. Although I won't continue repeating it. So anytime I have a subobject of M, then the phase of the subobject is less than or equal to the phase of the object M. So this is a little bit of an abstract definition, but let's work out what this means in our two examples. So let's start with the representations of, again, the quiver. So again, remember, we said that the stability condition is described by specifying two complex numbers. So Z1 will be the charge of the first object, and say Z2 will be the charge of the second object. Okay, and now I'm going to wonder about the object which I was denoting S earlier, which was this. Well, because its charge is the sum of the two charges, and Z is additive, its Z of S has to lie here. And now, what do I see? Well, I see that in S, I have a subobject, which is S2, sitting here. And that's the only one. And its phase is less than that of S. Therefore, S is semi-stable. Okay. So in this case, and of course, the simple ones are semi-stable because they have no subobjects. So in this case, the semi-stable objects, or if you will, the BPS brains are the two simples S1, S2, and S. And of course, they're multiples. Okay. So now let's take the opposite example where. Well, so first of all, anything is a sum of these three things. And then there's a little lemma that says that if you take two objects, then the sum is semi-stable if and only if each object is semi-stable and their phases are aligned. So in the generic situation which I depicted here, the only way you can get something semi-stable is by taking multiples of it, but you cannot interestingly combine them if you want to get semi-stable objects. You can in the abelian category, but, well, first of all, no, there are no exceptions because everything is a sum. Right. Well, there is a so. Well, there is a little. I mean, so let me just kind of a little lemma homework, which says M plus N is semi-stable if and only if M and N are semi-stable and they are of the same phase. Now, each object is a sum of these three, right? Of combinations of these three. But if you want to get that thing semi-stable, well, because these are not aligned, it has to be a trivial combination. So multiple of this one, or a multiple of this one, or a multiple of this one. And they're multiples. So there's still infinitely many, but there's three. Okay? There are three BPS rays, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Correct. So now let's do the opposite situation. Now, this is the charge of the second, it's the charge of the first, and of course, I still have my Z of S here. And now what I observe is that still S2 is a subobject of S, but the face of S2 is greater than the face of S. So here, S is not semi-stable. Okay. So here, the BPS brains are S1 and S2, and of course, understood, multiple. So S has disappeared, and as Greg says, here there is only two BPS rays. Yes, yes. Yes. No, equality is fine. This is semi-stable. You can also talk about stability, which is when the inequality is strict, but I'm not going to worry about that. Okay. And now for our second example, which was, say, coherent sheaves on X, where dimension of X is equal to 1. Well, this is a little homework. The BPS brains are, because this notion of phase is exactly equivalent to that of a slope, I mean, one is an increasing function of the other, so you get exactly the semi-stable vector bundles. And, okay, torsion sheets. This is for our favorite stability condition. And it's an. Yes, yes, that's right. Yes. No. Anyway, they're all always real objects, not virtual ones. Right? Okay. All right. And I suppose it's an interesting exercise whether you can actually rephrase, say, the semi-stability of a Higgs bundle in terms of a numerical thing like this. I'm sure it might be possible. Right? Okay. Now the goal we want to pursue is twofold. We want to first count in an appropriate sense semi-stable objects of charge alpha. And then secondly, we want to show that we have wall crossing. So the way we're going to do this is in two stages. We're going to first look at this. So this is going to be the set for now of objects which are semi-stable and of class alpha in the K group. Okay. And then what we want is to do some kind of count in an appropriate sense and associate to it some number, which will depend upon the class and the charge, which is going to be some dt invariant. And in the simplest cases, just to give you a flavor of what you would do in the simplest cases, you could take, for example, to be just a point count, if, say, you happen to be working on a category defined over a finite field. So that would be thought of as a kind of toy example. And perhaps. No, this would just be the sum, just the points, just the unsigned count. And then, if you were working over more realistically over the complex numbers, then you might want to take, for example, the Euler characteristic as count. Okay, so now here that there's a kind of a very important. Yes, yeah, so the kind of, yes, so I set it over the finite field, but you can think of it as motivic. Yeah. Yes, that's right. I mean, the count is a motivic invariant of varieties of a finite field. Yes, I mean, if you work, well, let me not give them, but for this is, for example, this is going to give you such a recipe, right? In these cases, this quiver is very simple, so most of the time, actually, the varieties, even over the complex number, are just a bunch of points, so then you're still counting them, even though you're over the complex number. No, if there's a bunch of points, they're just all in degree zero, right? There might be signs, I suppose. Yeah. Okay, let me. The same example as? Yeah, I think here there are no moduli in this A2. So I mean, there's not really much to. I mean, you can extract some numbers, but they're really, I kind of think, just an unsigned count. I could be wrong, but I think that's correct. So the basic observation that will allow us to get this going, and which goes back again to the work of Marcus Reinecke, and then was taken up again by Joyce, and by Koncevich and Seubelmann, is the following. So it goes in two steps. First, the observation, which is somewhat counterintuitive, is that it is much simpler to control or prove row crossing, not for the numbers, which in the end is what one is interested in, but rather for the varieties themselves. And then the second equally important observation is that to control row crossing for these varieties, there's an algebraic arena to do that, and the algebraic arena to do that is the so-called whole algebra of the abelian category. So let me start by, and then the picture goes roughly like this. So we said this is to do with the whole algebra. And then the fact that this gets mapped to some number, some DT invariant, will correspond to the fact that this whole algebra maps to a suitable quantum or symplectic or Poisson torus, depending upon the context, via a suitable integration map. And this is the torus of the K group. So when one speaks about symplectomorphisms or Poisson transformations, one is really thinking about things downstairs, and things are easier downstairs to the extent that you're only manipulating numbers, but to prove the properties that these numbers satisfy, it's infinitely simpler to look at them upstairs. That's the basic idea. So let me say something about this whole algebra as a vector space. This is a space of functions in a sense of, I'll say in a second, but just to give you a flavor on the moduli space, which I'll call M of objects of the abelian category. So you think you have some space which parameterizes all isomorphism classes of objects, and these are functions on that. Now, there's two caveats here. First of all, that M is a stack. So it's okay. And in fact, as Jan explained, in the most interesting geometric examples, and at any rate, certainly when you're talking about coherent sheaves, this is even an inconstructible stack. It's not even a stack of finite type. You have to. But for the case of the quivers, this is just a stack. So it's, for the case of quivers, it is. For quivers and in general representations of algebra, it is, because you just have some affine variety that labels all actions of the algebra on a given C to the D, and then you mod out by GLD. Okay. So that's the first caveat. And then the second is not really a caveat. It's right. So that's what's next. Absolutely. In that case, yes. And then the second is not really a caveat. It's just a qualification, which is by functions, one means so-called constructible functions. So by definition, these are kind of somewhat, I don't say that they're discrete, but they're functions of the form, they're functions of finite support, and their level sets are, are locally closed substacks. Actually, I'm being a little bit sloppy. For example, for the case that Greg mentioned, which is global quotient, what I would really like is, so I realize this is a global quotient of an affine variety, then I would take locally closed sub-varieties of the affine variety, which are invariant under the GLD action. So that's the kind of functions that I'm going to be working with. And the sum is finite, yes. Okay, now I have also a torus, T, which is, as I said, the torus dual to the K-lattice. And if I have a class in the K-group, then to it I can associate what Greg was calling a holomorphic Fourier mode. I'm just denoting it by a different letter. It's e to the alpha. And then there's a nice Poisson structure on the torus, induced by the homological algebra of the category, which is given by the following: E alpha E beta is some bilinear form, which I'll define in a second, times E alpha plus beta, and the bilinear form I have to define an auxiliary bilinear form first. So there is a so-called Euler form on this. There's the Euler form on the K lattice, which is a sign for a sum of the X. Yes, sorry. Thank you. And which is in general is neither symmetric nor anti-symmetric. If you're in a Calabi-Yau situation, then the serif functor gives you a symmetry of this, which is either symmetric or anti-symmetric, depending upon the dimension. Okay, and this angular thing is just the anti-symmetrization of. Of the Euler form. Okay, so now how does the count come? Well, the count comes in a way that is going to seem a little bit surprising, maybe, but maybe not so very surprising. it will come as a map, an algebra map, from the whole algebra to the algebra of differential operators on the torus. Okay. Now maybe let me say a few words. Inside the differential operators you have the vector fields, okay, and mapping to it you have the functions on the torus, because this is a Lie algebra under the plus one bracket, and the objects I'll be interested in will end up landing in here. Okay, so this is what this is. So we'll take a few words of explanation why that's so, in particular why what seems much simpler in the Q setting, in the motivic setting than Jan and Savish consider, which is that you have a motivical algebra, and here you just have quantum torus, you don't have differential operators. But the point is that the quantum torus, being non-commutative, acts upon itself in a non-trivial way. And when you specialize a Q is equal to 1, that action upon itself becomes an action by differential operator. Okay. Now, so that's for the moral contents. Now, for the mathematical contents, here there's a very big caveat, is that this integral exists only in very favorable circumstances. So let me mention two of them. One is if the global dimension of A is less than or equal to 1. So this was the case for representations of quivers and coherent sheaves on a curve. And then it was defined by Reinecke. And then the other, far more ambitious context is when A is a Calabi-Yau category of dimension 3, and then this map is what I understand to be the bulk of the construction in the paper of Konsevich and Seubelmann. Rather, what I'm talking about here is its semi-classical limit. So what they construct is... That's right. So it would go that you would first have a Q analog of this orientation map, going from motivic to quantum torus, the construction of which depends upon the orientation data, as I understand it. Yes, so orientation data, and then and then absence of pole conjecture. And then... Okay, yeah, well, I'm not an S1 here. But yes, it depends upon... Right, of course. Well, if you, for example, if you start, if you take a quiver and you start putting in relations, it means you add two cells, then the global dimension jumps up, and then I don't know that. Oh, it's a dimension of the relation, so to speak. So the quiver is a CW complex of dimension 1, right? But like this. But if you start putting, any algebra can be obtained from a quiver, but you have to put in relations, and you think of those as two cells and higher, and then makes that dimension go up. And then you lose the integration map. So as Jan explained in his talk, and I'm not going to make a very good job of saying what it is, but you have this Calabi-Yau superpotential, which makes so that these moduli spaces that you're interested in can be realized as the critical points of the Calabi-Yau superpotential, right? And then you have this Behrend invariant which allows you to actually attach a number to them. I mean, this motivic Milnor fiber and the machinery that Jan and Konsevich developed. Otherwise, you don't know. Is that? Okay, but you do need to think of the moduli spaces, as critical points of something. Well, actually, Jan and Konsevich work with the infinity category, so I would imagine the answer is yes. Okay, so let me just give you a flavor of what this is in the simpler case when the global dimension of A is less than or equal to 1. So again, for example, a quiver. Then if I start from, you remember we had this variety the scheme we were interested in, which is a scheme of all semi-stable objects with a given charge, and we can associate to it its delta function. Right, this is an element of the whole algebra, and upon integrating it, what one finds is a number times Poisson bracket with the corresponding. No, I'm not going to define it. That's right. So here is definition of Z is dependence on Z is suppressed. Okay. Okay, now let me say a few words, although this was already implicit in my discussion, about the algebra structure on this whole algebra. So I essentially define it additively as constructible functions on this moduli space, but there's a convolution product. So the convolution of two functions, I have to define its value at M, and this is going to be an integral, in a sense that I'll say in a second, over all subobjects of M, of f evaluated at n times g evaluated at m over n. Okay. Now, before I say what this is, the thing to keep in mind is that if I happen to be working over a finite field, then this would be literally a sum over subobjects of n. And you can notice here already that there's a dissymmetry resulting in the fact that this multiplication need not be commutative because I have a category which is not semi-simple, extensions one way are not extensions the other way. That's right, yes. Well, I can't, but Jan and Koncevich can, right? So they define this motivic whole algebra. And so, well, I'm not sure actually what Joyce does, but okay. Anyway, Koncevich and Silberman, they define motivic whole algebra starting from an inconstructible triangulated category. This integral is different from that integral, but has a similar flavor in a sense. I mean, here you're again taking the order characteristic. So this is the push-pull. This is the push forward of constructible. This is a called push forward of constructible functions. So yes. So I have to tell you what it is on, and this is just the order characteristic of the complex points of higher. Okay. Absolutely, yes. So I was going to say that this product, and in fact, with this product is related to, I mean, actually morally anyway, to the Harvey-Moore algebra of BPS states with two important caveats or differences, which I think would be very interesting to kind of patch and to understand. One is that we're working with very clunky functions. We're working with these constructible functions as opposed to working with smooth L2 functions, which is what Greg would do. And secondly, this is not an algebra of BPS states. This is an algebra of absolutely all states, right? We're not, as Greg observed, this is independent of Z, I mean, as a vector space and as an algebra, and this is very much dependent on Z. So there are some qualitative differences. I don't think they're very serious, but okay. There is a derived version. Okay. Well, it looks like we have something to talk about over tea and cookies then. So let me just say very, very basic things about this whole algebra. First, it has a unit 1, 1, 0, which is just the characteristic function of the zero object, okay, and which I would like to distinguish very carefully from a boldface one, which is a function which came up in Jan's talk, which is the function which is one absolutely everywhere. So it's a very boring function, but I mean it comes up. And then another maybe pretty things to say about the whole algebra is the way that the n-ary product looks like. And so if you take the product of n functions, then you have an integral, again in the sense of constructible functions, this time over n step flags of m, and then you evaluate the functions on the successive quotients. And this is actually essentially how you prove associativity, by showing that the products of three things written to in both ways reduce to a sum over an integral over three-step filtrations. Okay, well, now we're at a point where I can explain, so I don't know what my numbering went, but I can talk about wall-crossing formulas, and I can explain how they're implied by the existence of so-called harder Narasimhan filtrations. So let me remind you what these are. So if I take an object in A, then there exists a unique filtration of this object, which with the following properties. First, that the successive factors are semi-stable, and secondly, that their phases are strictly decreasing. So this is something that that generalizes the notion of Harder-Narasimhan filtration for vector bundles, which Harder-Narasimhan invented to recursively compute the Betti numbers of the moduli spaces of vector bundles. Okay, so now that we know this. Yes, so you're right. I'm being a little bit loose here. Normally, you're absolutely right. So when you define a stability condition, this is one of the requirements. You require that this be true, and if you have some very strong finiteness properties of the category, for example, if it has finite length, then this drops out. But it's definitely a requirement in general. I just didn't want to burden. Oh, no, that's automatic. That's for free. Okay, but I just didn't want to overburden axioms. Okay, now let's reformulate the existence of this filtration, and this is a formulation which is due to Reinecke, and this is really the origin of these wall-crossing formulas. So we're going to choose a ray, so a half line, and to it we're going to attach something which we're going to call SSL, which is going to be the unit plus the sum over alpha such that Z alpha lies in L of delta alpha. So this is the characteristic function of all semi-stable or BPS brains, if you like, of charge in L. 1, 0, the one that takes less effort to write. So this is the unit. Okay. So this is the characteristic function of technically zero and all semi-stable objects whose charge lies on, central charge lies on it. And then the observation of Marcus Reinecke is that the Harder-Narasimhan property implies, in fact, is equivalent to the fact that this clockwise product of characteristic functions taken over all half lines in the in the upper half plane is equal to the other one, namely this one. Okay. So I'm going to, for reasons of time, I was going to prove it, but I'm going to leave it as an exercise. But this actually follows, the gist of it is really to remark that such a thing should be true. But this really follows from the fact, from this Henery formula there. You basically expand the left-hand side, becomes a product of rays, and because the product of rays is evaluated as a sum over filtrations, this is going to test one only when you evaluate it on the Hardenberg Siemens filtration of an object, and zero on all others. And this, of course, is going to return one no matter what you feed it, and so there you go. Yes, so I was going to say, yes, this is a very, very crucial. So this is, let me just re-say this. So the corollary of this then is that if I take this product of arrays, okay, and now I'm going to reintroduce explicitly the dependence upon my stability condition, this is equal to the same product of characteristic functions, but for a different stability condition. And the reason is, it's trivial, it's because both sides, now, are equal to just a stupid function which does not depend upon Z. End of story. So this is why, this is wall crossing with the difference that you're not actually in the diffeomorphisms here, we're still upstairs. So we're still wall crossing in the whole algebra. Okay, and now, if we wanted to do, what one is really interested in, which is to say wall crossing in the simplex automorphisms of torus or in the Poisson automorphisms of the torus, you need a little proposition which says that the integral, when it is defined, of this characteristic function. So here I have to, let me write and then I'll explain. So it's a product of these Concewicz-Seubelmann simplex automorphisms and maybe alpha indivisible. So I guess the statement may sort of make sense, but let me explain why all of a sudden alpha indivisible. That you can't take half of it, or a third of it, or it's a generator. It's not the multiple of an element in the lattice. So, let me just try to just morally reconcile the fact that I said earlier that the integration map, when it is defined, maps the whole algebra to differential operators. Now, these elements, I've said they're in the whole algebra. I lied a little bit. They're actually in some completion of the whole algebra because they're infinite sums. And as it happens, they're exponentials of elements which are in a Lie algebra. So when you exponentiate them, they become group-like elements. The elements in the Lie algebra, they go to Hamiltonian vector fields, and the exponential becomes a simplex automorphism. Yes, that's I maintain that. No. Right. Yes. So alpha is just an element in the K group. So it's a charge in the K group. It's actually really an element in the cone of the K group, right? So it's a charge of a real object. It's a characteristic function of all semi-stable objects of that class. So all representations of a given dimension vector, which are semi-stable, for example, all coherent sheaves of a fixed Chern number. Right. Yes. So this is really what crossing for, where the sect. So yes, and the way Jan formulated it was that you had actually a convex cone, but it follows from this one actually. So that's right. 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 This is. Yeah, so the thing is, the reason why you have many cones is that you also want to go under the half plane, and I don't go under because there's nothing under here, because I don't have any anti-brains, right? But so long as you're happy to work with a fixed, which is a limitation, I grant it, then it's the same to say that the sector is that thing, or to say that it's some smaller. I mean, it takes a little bit of proof, but it's not a big deal. Okay, so let me now say something about Frobenius manifolds. So yesterday and today we heard from Greg and Andy that in physics, it's not even in physics actually. That was what we were presented with, was a mathematical construction of hyperkalon matrix from Mohr crossing formulas. Okay, modulo some solution of a Riemann-Hilbert problem, but I mean, there's no physics in this. I mean, and hyperkalon. Are you trying to? I'm the mathematician here. I'm supposed to be pedantic, not you. So, okay. So we heard about a construction of hyperkalon matrix from a number of data, including in particular Mohr crossing numbers and Mohr crossing formulas. Okay, and this is something that's related to KT star geometry. Now, part of the motivation of Joyce's work, as I understand it, prodded by. I beg your pardon? I know three physicists who do. This is exactly the same TT star as in Jan's talk, and because I'm short with time, I'm not going to discuss it. I actually here I mean it somewhat loosely, to the extent that you actually have an isomonodromic family of connections on P1, which with poles, irregular poles of 0 and infinity of Poincaré rank 1, which is parametrized by your hyperkalon manifold to B. Okay, so that's the sense in which I mean this. Now the motivation originally was the motivation of Tom Bridgeland, taken up by Joyce, was to construct Frobenius manifold structure on the space of all stability conditions on this abelian, and ideally triangulated category. So that was the question mark. And in particular, this should lead, if you're successful, to a flat connection, so let's call this M, on M cross P1. And at the risk of disappointing Greg, I'm going to call the coordinate on P1 T. I guess Greg couldn't because we already had a T here. With a regular singularity at T is equal to infinity and an irregular singularity at T is equal to 0. That's right. But I think it's better to keep them separate, because this is now to do with Frobenius as opposed to TT star geometry. So it's not the same P1. It's not the same. It's not a twister T. The T doesn't live in a twister P1. It's still a P1, but not a twister one. Okay. So what did Joyce do in this respect? Well. So he introduced this mirific generating function, which is a sum over all n, and then a sum over all n tuples of charges adding up to alpha of some weight functions he put forward an ansatz. With some weight functions, which for modesty he didn't call J, actually, that's the name we use, with some weight functions to be determined. Okay. And so he collected these pre-Donaldson-Tomlinson invariants in this generating function, which he thought of as a kind of Gromov-Witten potential. Okay. Not to be taken in a literal sense. Can I take 5 more minutes? Okay, and then what he showed is the following. So first of all, that there exists, you can choose these weight functions, their construction is intricate, but they exist such that these functions f alpha as functions of the stability condition are continuous and in fact holomorphic. Which, because of the wall crossing behavior, is definitely not true of the constituents delta alpha, which are locally constant and which are piecewise constant. Okay. Then he showed that these functions are essentially unique and in particular independent of A. So the construction he's giving as is sort of universal. And then he derived this really remarkable PD, which is df alpha is equal to 1/2 sum beta plus gamma is equal to alpha f beta f gamma d log beta over gamma. So he showed that there's an essentially unique way to put together these piecewise constant invariants into a function which is continuous holomorphic, and when you do that, out drops this nonlinear PD. Well, wait, one question at a time, and I have to turn on because so yeah. So what were the questions? So everything lives in the whole algebra, right? So this is the bracket this is a Lie bracket underlying the associative product. No. I mean beta over gamma. So B, well, the space of stability condition. Okay, so it's a small technique. Space of stability condition lives in the dual of the K group, right? So elements in the K group are linear functions in space of stability condition. So yeah, you would call this. Yeah. Okay. But I mean it's. Okay. Okay. And so. Right, so he obtained this extremely remarkable result and sort of left it at this, and in particular, it wasn't clear how to construct isomonodromic connections on P1. So what Tom and I did is the following. So we sort of worked, if you will, a little bit more generally. We pick at random an element in the whole algebra. I didn't insist upon that, but the whole algebra is graded by the K group. Okay. And you take an element, which I'm writing here in terms of its weighted components, and then I just tuck it into. I look at a connection with values in the whole algebra, which is the following. So connection on P1 with values in the whole algebra. Technically, the extended whole algebra, because I want the stability condition to also live in it. But that's not a big. And then what we showed was the following. Well, it isn't. So technically, you have to cross it here with. And what is it going to be? So this is okay. The carton, that's right. So it's really, yeah, it's really root values in this extended thing. Okay. And so what we showed is the following. That the following are equivalent. So one is this Joyce's construction, namely that F alpha bar is equal to F alpha is given by Joyce's generating function. I mean, what we were trying to understand is, I mean, what it was conceptually that Joyce was constructing. I mean, he took these things, they're unique enough, and so, but it wasn't clear conceptually what he was doing. So we understood that to say that something is given by the series is the same as tucking it into a differential equation of this kind, and then decreeing that the Stokes factors, the sort of the Stokes factor of this connection corresponding to a line, to array, L is SSL, which you remember was a characteristic function of all semi-stable objects whose central charge lands on the line L. And there's an equivalent and even simpler way to say that, which is to say that the Stokes matrices of this very same connection, so there are only two, which makes life simpler, are the first one, S plus, the one that corresponds to the upper half plane, is the Boring function 1. And then the one corresponding to the lower half plane is just, is 1, 1, 0. And this is morally so because there are no anti-brains. So of all brains, and this one is a product of all anti-brains, but there are no anti-brains. So in other words, it's a simpler way to say this is just to say, put an element F in that connection, and decree that its Stokes matrices are a characteristic function of all brains, characteristic function of all anti-brains, and out comes this expression. And then let me just conclude in a word. So, which is a corollary then. And it's a corollary of the fact that now we have a family of connections on P1 with values in this extended whole algebra. And its Stokes data, which I'm going to decide to read as its Stokes matrices, are clearly completely independent of the stability condition, right? Because Z doesn't figure here and doesn't figure there. And therefore, by definition, I have an isomonodromic family. On P1 of exactly the kind that you meet in Frobenius manifold. We have a pole of order 2 at 0, pole of order 1 at infinity. Okay. So I'll stop here. I beg your pardon? You want that, right, but yeah, so I agree that there's something to be clarified there, but definitely, yeah, there's something to be clarified there. This is definitely kind of, the mind set is a little bit different. So here's Frobenius versus TT star, which is what you're constructing as the flavor of. Yeah, yeah, no, that's what I'm, so that, I mean, so in, that's why, in a, that's why in a sense these two things are different. But there's definitely something to be understood there, I agree. I mean, TT star and Frobenius structures are not completely different. I mean, they're not the same either, but. Not exactly. So, yes, yeah, so part of the work consisted, actually, that's something that Tom discovered before we started working together, is that the better way to say this is actually to invert this series, to express those in terms of the Fs. And then what you have is multilog. So these are but then you can reflap the pancake, and then these are still multilogs, but they're summed over trees. So they're just more complicated combinations of multilogs. No, I did. No, I did not. I just said it's right. Well, no. There's two things. The case form is something that has nothing to do with integration. Something, some identity in the symplectic morphisms of the torus. The question is, do you have a context which produces interesting instances of that? And so the work of Koncevich and Sobelman, conjecturally at least, produces an instance of that starting from a three-dimensional Calabi-Yau category. So it actually produces you some numbers, omega alpha z. Yes, to the integrate. And I explained that that is actually exists only very rarely. So there's two contexts in which it exists. So Calabi-Yau 3, that's the work of Koncevich and Sobelman, and then dimension 1, that's the work of Reinecke. Then there is an integration map. Without relations. Yes, without relations.
But that integration map is different from the integration
It's not exactly the same. It is actually very similar, because what you're taking is you're taking essentially the order characteristic. I mean, over a finite field, you would count points, and so yes, so it's very similar in flavor. Right, so let me define the integration map. I mean, maybe to dissipate, so let me define the integration map over a finite field, and just to be a moment. So the integration map of the characteristic, so this is, okay, so over a finite field, okay, the integration map, so then things are discrete, so you have a basis of the whole algebra consisting of just objects, I mean, or delta functions on the object, if you like. Maybe I can write it like this. Okay, and this is just then, how shall we write it? With e to the m, this is the element, so now m is the element of K-theory that corresponds, and then this is the corresponding holomorphic Fourier mode, divided by aught m. That's it. So it's an orbifold count.
And that's a function on the K-theory torus.
Yes, this is a function of the K, and then it's... Well, no, because now we're over a finite field, right?
Yeah, okay, but my question was really about the finite.
Okay. Well, then I think, but okay, so this I'm definitely sure of, and this modulo check, but I think it should be true, and it's not quite the same delta function, that then it becomes the order characteristic of the variety, well, not exactly the variety, but something related to it, times e to the m, Poisson bracket with. So this would be over C. This is... No, well, you could take it as a definition. I mean, or you could take this as a definition and then work out the semi-classical limit. No, something happened with the denominator, and it's not the same delta. So obviously, this definition doesn't work at Q is equal to 1, because this... So there's a motive. Yeah. What is Q? Depending upon. Yes. Yeah, so this is a Q is equal to 1. Right, no, but the first thing I wrote is that the integration map went from the whole algebra at Q is equal to 1 to differential operators, then explained some parts of the whole algebra, essentially which live in a Lie algebra, go to vector fields, and in fact Hamiltonian vector fields. And then these Stokes things that I was writing, this SSL, they're actually exponentials of elements in the Lie algebra, so they go to the exponentials of vector fields, and those are symplectic morphisms. Right. No, that's not difficult. The thing is, right, so you would like... Yes. But the tricky thing is, and actually the thing is, which is actually wrong in general, is that this thing is not going to be an algebra homomorphism. Unless you're in dimension 1. So, and if you don't have an algebra homomorphism, you're stuck, because you have a nice wall crossing formula upstairs, and you can't push it down, and so you're stuck. So yeah, you can actually, again, have fun with this formula over a finite field. It's easier to manipulate. Again, check that only if global dimension of A is equal, less than or equal to 1 is this an algebra homomorphism into the quantum torus. Because both ingredients are defined. I mean, the whole algebra and the quantum torus is defined. Right. In dimension 3, yeah. And so that's what Jan and Jan and Konsevich worked out. That's right. Yes. So nothing I've said is really. Right. So in a sense, well, in the end, pragmatically speaking, you're only interested in the numbers, and the numbers are they're a semi-classical construct. There's no Q. The point of going, as I understand it, the point of going over to the Q picture, is that this integration map is difficult to define directly. The one to differential operators, it is relatively easier, but by no means easy, to construct it in the Q setting and then judiciously send Q to 1. Well, that's a very interesting question, of course. I'm not completely clear. So one would expect that you could talk about Q difference equation. I mean, certainly there is such a thing as Q difference equation with irregular singularities, and you might want to think whether you can think of those as the Stokes factors of such a Q difference equation, for example. Well, there is actually a fairly well-developed theory of Q difference equations. As far as I know, no. So, but yeah, of course, it's a very interesting question. How this theorem Q deforms. Oh, okay. That's true. Okay, so yes. Right. Well, I don't think you're going to be able to get vector spaces out of the whole algebra, because the whole algebra is again function. So you have to, if you want to categorify numbers to vector spaces, you also have to categorify the whole algebra. And the way to categorify the whole algebra, for example, is instead of taking constructible functions, you take constructible sheaves, or complexes of constructible sheaves. Right. Well, I'm not. I think Greg is making two points, and I can only try to answer one of them, which is this categorification issue. Which is, again, if you want, you can certainly categorify the numbers. I mean, as you say, you have a candidate which is the space of BPS states rather than its dimension, and also has a categorification, which would be instead of looking at constructible functions on the stack, you look at constructible sheaves, complexes of constructible sheaves on the stack. Okay. Then you have the function which associates the order characteristic over each point. This kind of that gives you constructible function. So then you would imagine. I don't know that has been worked out, but you could imagine there's a categorified integration map that goes from this categorified whole algebra to produce the actual vector space of BPS states. That's definitely. That's right.
Yes,
yes.
Consider
the module.
Okay, that sounds slightly different, right? I mean, but right. I mean, it seems like a different deformation. I mean, I think Greg is talking about categorifying. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.